Board Game Bros.
Hello, listeners.
Hey, everybody.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We are brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. And we're coming at you with another regularly scheduled bi-weekly episode where we are going to choose one board game. We're going to discuss how it's played. We're going to discuss some strategies in the game. And then we're going to talk about how it was designed. So, Matthew, what game are we talking about today?
We are talking about Love Letter, designed by Seiji Kanai and published it by AEG in 2012. And it won a bunch of Golden Geek Awards. It won Origins Best Traditional Card Game of 2014. And it was a Spiel des Jahres recommended in 2014 as well.
All right.
Along with a bunch of other stuff.
Cool. So for a short description of what Love Letter is all about, in Love Letter, players aim to eliminate their competitors and deliver their love letter to the princess to win her heart. At the start of the game, players are dealt one card each, and on a player's turn, they draw one card and play one card. The goal of the game is to be the last player standing, or to have the card of the highest number in their hand when all the cards have been drawn from the deck. And that's basically it. It's a pretty simple game. There's two victory conditions for any given round of the game, which is to, again, eliminate all the other players, or rather be the last player standing, or have the highest number card in your hand at the end of the round. And then depending on the number of players, the person who wins, you know, X number of rounds first wins. So in a four-player game, that is three rounds. The person who wins three rounds first wins. More of this game will be a little more apparent, or what I mean by having the highest number card will be a little more apparent when we get into the details. So let's start talking about how to actually play the game.
Right.
There's a deck of 16 cards.
Yeah.
And, they're numbered between 1 through 8. And, I don't have the game. Do you have the game in front of you right now?
Not in front of me, but I remember everything.
Of course.
Everything.
Yes, he does. The cards are numbered 1 through 8. I know there are five number one cards.
There's two number twos, two number fours, two number fives, one number six, one number seven, and one number eight.
Mm-hmm. That should be a total of 16, I believe. So those are the numbers of the cards. And obviously, at the end of a round, if you are the player who has the one number eight card in your hand, then you are guaranteed to win. But each of these cards has an effect associated with them. And during gameplay, when it comes to your turn, you draw one card and then play one card to use its effect. So Matthew, what are the effects of all the cards?
Right. So, the number one is the guard. And when you play the number one, you choose another player and name a number 2 through 8, so it cannot name one. And if that player has that number in their hand, they're eliminated, and that number, or that card, is revealed face up and discarded. If they do not have it in their hand, then they just say they don't have it in their hand.
Mm-hmm. There is sort of a level of trust involved in having to play this game. So there is that to the game, but it doesn't really make a huge difference. But yes, you have to be honest when someone says, like, do you have any of this number? Much like Go Fish.
Number two is the priest, which when you play it, lets you look at another player's hand. Number three is the baron, where you compare the card remaining in your hand with the card that another player has in their hand, and whoever has the lower number loses or is knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
Number four is the handmaid, which says that until your next turn, you can't be chosen by other players' cards. So like the guard or the baron that says choose another player, the handmaid stops those.
Mm-hmm. From choosing you.
Yeah. Number five is the priest, which says that another player discards a card from their hand and draws a new one. The number six is
the king. Number five is the prince.
Sorry,
right?
Prince. Yeah, you're right. Number six is the king, who lets you trade hands with another player.
Mm-hmm.
Number seven is the countess, which says if you have the prince or the king in your hand, you must play the countess.
And then otherwise, the countess has no effect.
Yeah. And then number eight is the princess, who says if the princess is discarded from your hand, you lose.
And that goes for playing as well.
Yeah.
is to play a card is sort of to discard it.
Right. At the start of the game, each player is dealt one card, and then when you take your turn, you draw a card before you play one, so mm-hmm. when you're actually choosing what to play, you'll have two cards in hand, but on every other player's turn, you'll just have one.
Yes. And it's also important to note that at the start of the game, before you deal every player one card, you remove one card from the deck, so that you can never truly guess exactly what is in someone's hand, even when it comes down to the last card being drawn from the deck.
You can't perfectly count cards.
Exactly. But otherwise, the card count is low enough that you feasibly can, you can get pretty accurate with your card counting or card guessing, at least. And that's basically it for how to play the game. You know the effect of every card, and you know that players take turns until either everyone has been eliminated. Obviously, when you're eliminated, then you can no longer participate in that round. And so it'll either come down to one player standing, or if multiple players are still in the game by the time the last card is drawn from the deck, then players compare their cards in hand, and whoever has the higher number card in hand wins. Right. And if that's a tie, then you count up the numbers on the cards that you've played that round, and whoever has the highest total from those will win then. Right. And it should be noted that when you play a card or discard a card, either way, you keep it face up in front of you so that, not only does it keep track of your card so that at the end of the game you can do that tiebreaker, but also it can help you and other players track what cards have been played to help you make guesses for the purposes of cards like the guard. So like if you played a card, and let's just get into strategy at this point, because we're kind of getting there.
Yeah.
And I'll finish this thought and then we'll talk about more broad strategy. But if you play a guard, you can like look at the battlefield and see like, okay, both of the princes have been played, both the handmaidens have been played. A number of guards have been played, but you can't guess guard with a card. But you could say like, oh, nobody's played a baron, so I'll guess that you have the baron in your hand. All right, so strategy.
Yeah, so that basically covered my first point, which is keep track of discard piles.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you see what cards have been played, what cards haven't been played, which also you kind of touched on my second point, which is to play percentages. So, like, if there are more cards that are five or more, as in, like, number five or more remaining mm-hmm. that haven't been played, than cards that are four or less, then if you're playing a guard, you should probably guess, in general, like, the higher numbers in that scenario. So, you know, using the cards that have been discarded to kind of educate yourself when it comes to your guard playing is pretty mm-hmm. crucial.
And guard playing is kind of like the centerpiece of a main round of gameplay, because that guard is basically the only card other than, I mean, Baron can eliminate people, but it's less likely to eliminate people. It's way easier to eliminate somebody with a guard.
Yeah.
So being able to make the reads around the table and guess what people have with the guards, but also in a way kind of keep your own hand ambiguous is one of the keys, at least to making it towards the end of a hand or the end of a round.
Yeah. The Countess can be a big liability late game if the king/princes haven't been played, especially because like if there's only a few cards left in the deck and it's close to the end game that way and you play a Countess, chances are that you have the king or the prince, because like why else would you play a Countess that late in the game? The only thing that can beat it is the princess. Playing the Countess early on can kind of trick people so that they waste guards.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, it's just worth noting that, like, you know, if you have the Countess in hand, don't always bank on keeping it for the end game, checking who has what numbers.
Sure. The Countess can give a lot away at the end of the game, like you're saying, where like you might just happen to be forced to play it and leave yourself vulnerable for one last guard, or at least like give yourself away that the person with the princess knows that they're kind of safe.
Yeah.
Maybe they know.
That is unless the king or the princes have been played, in which case it's a little safer. The prince also, by the way, is a pretty strong card. Like, yes. For one thing, number five isn't too low.
I mean, all the cards higher than it, there's only one of. So
yeah,
it's like kind of a break point at five.
But late game, it can kill princesses since it forces the player with the princess to discard it, and then they are out of the game. So, like, if somebody's holding on to princess late game, that's a way to take them out. Mm-hmm. And then also, since if you don't kill a princess with it, they draw a new card, it's pretty good to force a quicker end game. If you think about it, like, the timer of the game is how many cards are in the deck. Then, if you're pretty sure that your other card than the prince is a good card, like a king or something, then playing the prince lets you kind of cycle that through and essentially end the game or turn quicker.
Yeah.
So
I think it's important to know your outs. That's a concept in a lot of competitive games. I mean, knowing your outs is just kind of knowing what is the path to victory at any given moment. And in this game, it's important because sometimes, you know, we talked a little bit about playing probability with the guards, saying like it's more likely that you have a number between this and this in your hand, so I'll guess around that neighborhood. It could also just be important, like, to play a guard just to check and see if somebody has a card in their hand that could beat you. Like, right. For example, if you have a prince in your hand, you know, you could be playing the odds and see that, like, oh, none of the handmaidens have been played, none of the number four cards have been played, so I'm going to guess that you have a four because I'm more likely to eliminate you. But instead, you could just say, like, oh, the duchess has been discarded and the person holding the princess was forced to discard it, so that just leaves the king in the game that could beat me, so I'm just going to guess and see if you have the king. And if you do, then I've eliminated the one thing that can beat me, and if you don't, then I'm beating you anyways.
Yeah. Another example would be if you have the princess and a guard, you can play a guard and name prince so that you check whether or not somebody can make you discard it on their next turn.
Right. Another thing that you can technically do with a guard is make it misleading what you have in your hand. Like, there's nothing that stops you from guessing if somebody has the same card as you in your hand, even if that's a one-off card. So if you have the king in your hand and you play a guard and you guess if somebody else has the king, that kind of subtly clues to people at the table that you don't have the king in your hand, even though you do.
Right.
It can be a waste of a turn, but if your card is a high enough number, like the king or the duchess or the princess, then it doesn't matter that it wastes a turn because you're playing to the end of the game, which is your out in this case. Your out is to get to the end of the game and have the highest number card.
Right. Likewise, sort of once you get a feel for what your outs will be, you can try to guess what the opponent's outs are. Based on the cards they play or the decisions they make, you can kind of figure out what they're trying to do. So, if somebody else has a guard and they name Prince, then they probably have, you know, at least the 6, 7, or 8 in that case. Mm-hmm. So you can figure, like, if I play a card, like a guard, I can name, you know, the princess in case they have a princess in their hand, or they have a king or a count, you know, stuff like that. Like, you can kind of try to read that way.
Sure.
This is a deduction game, and like a lot of the deduction games we've covered, it really is something that will evolve, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, you know, you can play a guard and name the card you have in hand, but if you keep doing that over and over, it'll be obvious that you're naming the card you have in your hand.
Sure.
So really just, like, mix up sort of the tactics you're using is what I'm trying to say.
Right. Similarly, I mean, maybe not similarly. Another way that you can make reads in this game is just kind of, obviously watching other people's moves. There's a lot that can be learned from just like what somebody does. There can be a lot that can be learned when it looks like somebody's doing something random or doing something that doesn't quite make sense to you. Like one example is somebody using a priest to see a card in somebody's hand, and then the next turn, either not targeting them with a guard or not targeting them with like a baron or something. You can kind of figure out what they know based on how they're playing. And then, or like when people trade hands, that gives away a lot of information, the way that they behave after they trade hands.
Right. Oh, speaking of which, if you have a guard and a king in hand, don't use the king.
Yeah.
Because whoever you trade the guard to will know what you have in your hand now, and they can just knock you out. Mm-hmm. So unless you really want to play politics and be like, no, don't use the guard on me, use it on them, then it's probably not worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see. Do you have any more? Yeah, also another thing to like think about what somebody's not doing, you could also kind of try and think about what they're not playing. Like, they had two cards in their hand, why didn't they play their other card?
Yeah.
Like, personally, I believe that like cards like the priest, they either give away that you have a guard in your hand that you're trying to use next game or next turn to take away whatever they saw. Or you just have something really good that you don't want to give away, like a duchess or a princess. So you have to play the priest. I think that there's very few situations where I'd play a priest just against any other card personally. So there's something like that that you could divine from why they play a card. Right. Similarly to like why they play a handmaiden.
Yeah, especially like, late game.
Are they playing that because they have the princess, or they just... They have something that could be easily guessed by a guard.
Or they have something, but they want to wait for other people to play cards to get more information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a lot to be deduced in this game. There's a little bit of bluffing involved, but I find this game is almost purely... I think I saw this game described as a luck and deduction game.
Yeah.
There is some amount of luck, especially like if you're just straight up going for like... eliminate as many people as you can, as fast as you can, then you just kind of have to like make kind of wild guesses with guards. Do you think wild guesses with guards are worth it?
Usually, because the guard's a one otherwise, so like I guess it depends on what the other card in your hand is, but usually I find myself wanting to empty a guard anyways.
I think that might be a little irrational, because
maybe
so a baron is the only way to take someone out who has a guard.
Yeah,
because a guard cannot name another guard, and every other card besides the baron can't eliminate a player. They can only like give up information or eliminate yourself, except for I guess a prince can eliminate the princess, but that's a rare occurrence. So a guard isn't that that unsafe a card to have in your hand. Except because barons exist.
Yeah.
I think because of that, it's kind of okay to like, if you do throw out an early random guard, the baron is your best thing to call out.
Yeah.
Sort of just playing to your outs. If you have guards in hand, then you want to get rid of barons. I mean, that's to say if you play a guard and you have another guard in your hand.
Yeah. I think the way I would put it is like turn one, I think it's okay to blindly guess, but you know, after everybody's played like two or three cards, then maybe you might want to hold on to a guard, either because it's safer or because you can snipe somebody with it later.
Sure, you might want to play your handmaid or your maybe it's more like you could play a guard early on, but then you want to hold your guards if you see the game coming to a last man standing scenario and not a highest number. Because again, I guess the other downside of a guard, of course, is that it's the lowest number and it's never going to win at the end of a hand. So you have to hope that it's coming down to two people, you and somebody else, and you have a guard.
Yeah.
And in that case, it's good to hold on to them. I think somewhere in the middle, it's probably poor to use a guard just because like eliminating like one other person when there's still so many left in the game isn't super good. Because I don't know, maybe it makes it more likely that you get targeted by something that takes you out.
Yeah.
The
fewer people there are in the game, the more turns you'll have, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, it'll get around to you more often before the deck runs out of cards. But, yeah, other than that, like, I can't think of a reason why you'd want to target one person in the middle of the game, unless you know they have something that will win for, like, you know, going to the end game and Like, if you know they have, like, a princess or something, or a king.
Right.
Then that's
It should
good.
Also be brought up at this point that, like, this game is played over a number of rounds, so you don't, the game doesn't end and you don't win after you get to the end of a round and you have the highest number or you're the last person standing. The way this game works is after you win a round, you get a little token that shows that you won, and then after you've acquired so many tokens, you actually win the game as a whole. So I guess another reason why you might want to use your guards a little more aggressively is just because there's one player who's on match point. You know, in a four-player game, they have two of these win tokens. I think they're called favor tokens. You have two of these, they have two of these favor tokens, and you need to take them out so that they don't have a chance of winning the third and ending the game completely.
Yeah.
All right. Shall we talk about design?
Yeah, sure.
Obviously this is a very elegant game. I mean, I don't know, maybe elegant isn't the exact word for it, especially how we've used it to describe games in the past. But it's a very simple game with very few pieces that still has a good amount of complexity to it.
Yeah. I realize that it's kind of gateway-y. Because, like, so the decisions in the game are kind of streamlined. Because, like, even if you have to think through, you know, like, what opponents might have in their hands or all that, it's still just a decision between two cards. And some cards make that decision a bit more complex as well, with, like, who you target or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But you still only have two cards every turn that you play. And since the amount of cards you can play never increases and information only goes up as the game progresses, it means that, like, as the game gets longer, there are fewer reads necessary.
Yeah.
Or it kind of speeds up. Easier to make reads.
Yeah. It becomes more player-friendly towards the end of the game.
Yeah.
More new player friendly.
And the fact that information gets greater the longer the game goes means that new players are more likely to be able to eliminate people with guards as the game progresses, which means that, like, they're able to get to that core gameplay element of elimination.
Yeah. Right. And then, it feels really good when you make the read and then get the guard
kill
that you want.
And so, like, it has these elements of a gateway game where, like, you know, it's on a kind of even playing field because there is luck involved, but not too much, but not too little. And the cool elements of the game, that's kind of the draw of the game, is pretty accessible. And there's not a huge information overload most of the time. Mm-hmm. Even the fact that there's, like, the whole number thing is a pretty simple guidepost to base your hand decision off of. You know, sure. Do you play the 2 or the 5 early game? Well, probably the 2, because the 5's the bigger number. And also, since information clears up as the game goes on, it helps reduce mental fatigue. Since, you know, like, when you're playing one round of Love Letter, at the start there might be a lot of information to keep track of after, like, the second hand, or after the second turn for everybody. Mm-hmm. But as it goes on, there's less information to have to consider, like, less possibilities. So yeah, that's why, like, it feels like a gateway game to me.
Sure. It also is very player friendly that the more powerful effects are on the smaller number of cards.
Yeah.
So, I mean, first of all, it encourages you to play them. Not to mention that there's more of the lower number cards than the higher number cards. So, like, there's more action in a game and you're more encouraged to play them because you don't want to have them in your hand at the end of the game. You'd rather have a higher number card. So it just kind of makes sense, like, where they put the abilities. Like, they could have put the eliminate a player ability on card number 3, or, I mean, well, they did, or card number 4 or 5. But instead they put it on the lowest, like, most common card is the most powerful card.
Right.
And then the second most powerful card is, I mean, you can make an argument that it is the number 2 card, because it gives you information without giving away anything. Although I think the next most powerful card is probably the 3rd, or where, because it's another card that can eliminate somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't eliminate them, then what it does is it paints a target on the person who you failed to eliminate, because like if you choose someone with the Baron, that means you're comparing your other card to their card, and whoever has the lower number is eliminated. If you're eliminated and you show the card that you held, you show like a five or a six, then that just is like, oh, they have a big number card, they'll be taken out too. So it's like, even if you fail, you still probably succeed.
Right.
So that's why it's kind of like the second strongest card. But yeah, all those cards are at the bottom end, which means that people are more likely to play them because they don't want to hold on to them for too long. I mean, it's kind of like we said, like, after thinking about this game, especially during this recording, I'm thinking that, like, I probably play guards too quickly. Probably should wait much longer. I should hold on to guards later. But I do play them quickly because I'm like, I don't want to keep a one in my hand. What if a Baron targets me? But because the game is designed the way it is, you know, we play them and we make things happen and people drop out and the game speeds up and then eventually, you know,
yeah,
we experience everything the game has to offer us.
Right. I think it's really cool the way this game is balanced kind of inversely.
Mm-hmm.
How you mentioned how, like, the lower numbers are typically the stronger ones.
Mm-hmm.
To turn this around into, like, something that you can implement in game design, it's Love Letter has two endgame states, and every card works towards one of those endgame states. But the ones that are best at one of them is also the worst at the other. And that's just, like, pretty typical balance that, like, you have specialization in that regard.
Mm.
And everything under that is kind of equal. Like, technically you can eliminate people with the prince or put pressure on people with the king. Or, you know, you can play the priest and look at somebody else's hand to know what numbers you need to be worried about, you know. So it's not necessarily everything is only for one of those endgame states, but like, if you want to have like an even spread of this is good for this and this is good for this, a good way to do that is just have the different game pieces kind of opposite each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is something a lot of competitive games especially do, is like, there'll be the question of when do you want the game to end, and things that are good at ending the game early fall off later on. Things that are ending the game much later are harder to do early. This is sort of with like, I guess this game doesn't have as many because the later it goes, the more likely it is to eliminate people. I guess it's more that if you have like a princess in hand, there's more ways you can lose by elimination, if that makes sense.
Right.
Just because more cards will eliminate you. Though I guess
they'll implicate you.
Yeah.
So that others can eliminate you.
Yeah.
Like it kind of goes both ways.
Right. I think it's interesting how this is a deduction game that doesn't actually give you many ways to look at what people have. If mm-hmm. that makes sense. Cause like,
right. It's almost purely deduction. Like without. Yeah. It's almost purely deduction without like any information.
Yeah. It's weird. Cause like, maybe I just haven't played many deduction games, but like, it's interesting to me how like, there's only one card that really lets you look at another player's hand, but because there's only one card in hand at any given time, it kind of doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can always just play that card.
Yeah.
If it's a playable card, like a prince or a king.
Yeah. So
like, even if it's something they'd want to hold on to, they might just play it so that you don't know what's in their hand.
Yeah, in a way, the low hand sizes kind of forces you to keep track of the discards and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
Because I mean, speaking of low numbers.
Yeah, because hands are so, like, volatile.
Yeah. Yeah, so speaking of low numbers, like, this game only has 16 cards. Makes it super easy to just understand and have it locked down. It's kind of like this is a game where, obviously there's a benefit for understanding how many of each card are in the deck. But this game kind of wants you to just get over that hump, like that information block, that gate to playing the game as quickly as possible. Obviously, they give you a rules text card to keep with you that not only tells you what every card does, but tells you how many of those cards are in the deck. So you can just always reference back to that. If you forget there's five guards, then you could see like on that card, oh, there's five guards, and you can look out and count, oh, there's five guards. Speaking of, like, if the game forces you to keep everything face up and spread out so that you can keep track of cards, it doesn't ask you to count. So this also speaks to the gateway aspect of it, just that they kept the count so low, so there wasn't really much to memorize to understand the game, and then they give you so much information and help. It's nice. It makes the game. It makes it so that like lots of people can play the game. Once you get into the game, you only have to focus on the most fun parts of the game, but the most interesting parts of the game, as the designers have decided. And they leave all the complicated things that could make it for like maybe a more deep game. They just kind of say like, eh, we don't really need that much depth. We'll just let the depth come from the deduction.
It reminds me of beginner-friendly fighting games, where instead of having like weird control stick inputs, they will just have like button plus direction, because it eliminates an entry barrier. In this game, it's not even like a barrier to entry that prevents you from playing, but one that prevents you from doing things consistently. It's sort of almost a quality of life change. And like you said, yeah, they could have done more cards or a bigger deck or more complicated stuff, but it definitely seems like the intention was to make it easy to keep track of things.
Mm-hmm. Now we played, this is the copy of the game that we played was technically the Love Letter Deluxe Edition. It had the base game in it, and that is, we did play the base game, which is with these few cards that we've described. Before we recorded this episode, to get like a complete idea of what the game Love Letter in its base form, in its original form, is supposed to feel like and play like and stuff like that. But with the deluxe edition, they have all these extra cards, you know, at the different number levels. So there's another number two type card that does something else, and another number three, and there's multiples of them, and there's another seven, the Dowager Queen. And there's a bunch of other stuff added to the game. There's cards that go higher than eight. I think there's a nine in the deluxe edition. And I think the deluxe edition is mostly just to play with more than five players, because that's the limit for Love Letter, the base game. But even still, it adds more complexity to the game. And I think personally, like, I think I like both games equally. Like, I enjoy the complexity and the chaos, which is especially necessary when there's way more people in the game. So there needs to be like more, I don't know, elimination. It needs to be harder to read people, and information needs to be flying a little bit more around the table. So that's why there's card effects added that like make two other players switch their hands and you get to peek at one of them.
Yeah.
But then there's something that's nice and fun and simple about this basic game. You know, you and I, we like complicated games, but I think we both say that like just the base Love Letter is still a super enjoyable game to play.
Yeah. See, I do like simplified games when there is depth to them, which this game feels like there's an appropriate amount of depth to the base game. I think the expanded version has more like plot twists, if that makes sense, like more unexpected things can happen.
Yeah, more curveballs.
And since it goes longer, yeah, there's a lot more curveballs, as you said. But I do personally like the calculatedness of the base game by itself.
Yeah, I think they struck a good balance. And I like that. Yeah, you can really get into the reading. I think it was funny, like when we were playing in preparation for this game, I also had my Switch with me, and like there were some hands when I would just be like totally invested in the game, and I was like paying attention to every play and making every read and like trying to figure out what everyone had in hand and maneuvering for victory. And then there were some games when I was like trying to grind to fight a find a 5 IV Ditto in a max raid. And so like there were some hands where I really wasn't paying attention. I was just kind of playing the cards out of my hand. And I'm pretty sure I won at least one round both ways. Like I won a round all in invested, and I won a round not, you know, kind of distracted.
Yeah.
If anything, that speaks to how this is definitely a good gateway game, because like someone who doesn't want to do all that thinking can still get success, can be successful in this game.
Yeah.
But if you do all the thinking, then it can for sure pay off.
Oh yeah. I think the three rounds in a row that I won at the end were the result of like much more careful decisions than my first however many games up until that point.
Mm-hmm.
Mixed with a little bit of playing around, expecting people to target the people in first.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Do you have any more design considerations?
Not really. Yeah, no.
Okay. Does this game remind you of any other games that sort of like you get in what you put into it, or you get out what you put into it, like strategy planning wise, but it's still like functional?
Like, I guess that's how most gateway games are.
Sure.
I think Carcassonne is a good example of a game that has like a very, very open floor, but a really high ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
But you can still play like kind of autopilot. Same with King Domino.
Yeah.
But as far as deduction games,
King Domino also sort of has a very similar like stratification of strength.
Oh yeah.
Sort of like the most common thing is like the weakest, and the rare thing is the strongest. That's not how Love Letter goes, but it's sort of like it has a similar deal.
It's like you make a balancing.
You make a similar decision in that game when you're like planning a strategy, like whether to go for the high number or whether to go for elimination. It's similar to like whether to go for like a wide territory that with a weaker upside, or a rare territory that might be contested.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a direct correlation, but I think it makes sense. It makes sense in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of, yeah. Anyways, as far as deduction games go, I mean, there's tons of deduction games.
Yeah.
We've covered a couple of them. I think we did a whole episode on bluffing and deduction.
Yeah.
But the bluffing aspect isn't really part of this game. It's a little bit like we said about like misleading people with your guards, or maybe like playing a countess when you don't have to play a countess.
Right.
But since this game is like so short, there's not a lot of chances for people to, like, I don't know. It makes more sense to get better use out of your pieces in this game.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, there's other bluffing and deduction games that you could check out. And we did a whole episode on bluffing and deduction if you're interested to get deeper into the genre.
And Citadels. We did an episode on Citadels kind of recently, like a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
All right. So with that is the end of our episode on Love Letter. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
If you like, you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can hit us up with suggestions for games there. We really appreciate all the feedback that you guys give us. And we take it all into consideration. And we pretty much tried out every game that listeners have suggested to us. And we just recently did get a suggestion for a game. So look forward to that soon. We'll let you know when we are going to review that, our faithful listeners. You can go to bgbcast.com to find all our episodes cataloged and categorized by the games that we talked about it, or the subjects that we talk about in them. So if you want to find our bluffing and deduction game, or you want to find our games on Citadels or Carcassonne, you can find those tags. Those will take you straight to the episode. And again, if you don't find an episode of us discussing a game that you're interested in, hit us up with those suggestions on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. Let's see. If you want, you can go to our TeePublic store to check out our cool merch. We're planning on putting up some more merch sometime soon, so be on the lookout for that. That's teepublic.com/user/BGBcast, or you can find the link on our website, bgbcast.com. And we have a Patreon. So check out our Patreon. The link, you can find a link to our Patreon on our webpage. Matthew, I'll let you give more details on the Patreon.
That is patreon.com/user/BGBcast. For at least $1 a month, you can get a shout out during an episode, as well as you can send us a question that we'll ask during an episode. But we have neither of those in stock, in queue. So if you want a shout out and a question to ask us, feel free to, you know, support us on Patreon to get those. As well, if you support us at $5 or more, you get access to two monthly series. That is Board Game Bros The Dusty Shelf, in which I dust off an old game that we wouldn't normally cover on here and talk about sort of its history, the game's strategy and design as well. Sort of what makes it so long-lasting. I've done episodes on Uno and Scrabble so far that have been pretty neat. And then you also will get Board Game Bros Let's Make a Game, where I make a game over the podcast, and you can kind of get a snapshot into the creative process, the game development process, including literal snapshots of the process, because I post photos in the Patreon posts with a bit more detail written in as well over like the prototypes and whatnot.
All right. And then how about some Matt plugs?
Matt plugs. So I stream on twitch.tv/twack. That is twitch.tv/TWAK. I stream on Monday, Wednesday, Friday from about 1 p.m. Central Time to 4 p.m. Central Time. Still kind of working on getting a schedule that works for me. I stream roguelites, competitive games, platformers. I speedrun. I play fighting games. I started streaming a lot more Teamfight Tactics recently, which is pretty fun. So if you want to watch me and talk about games and whatnot in the stream chat, then you can follow me there. You can also join a Discord through that Twitch channel, if you look in the description of it, where you can talk to me, Jeff, and other fans of our work. And you can follow me on Twitter at Matt Craig Gaming to get updates on when I go live, as well as other various updates and tweets and stuff.
All right, that does it for Matt plugs. As for some Jeff plugs, I stream as well on twitch.tv/radicalhawks. That's twitch.tv/radical, H-A-W-K-Z, one word. Check me out. I stream Wednesday evenings consistently, and then I've been trying to find time over the weekends to stream as well. I stream, just got finished beating Dark Souls, which was exciting, and I also sometimes stream Pokemon. I'm probably going to stream some more of that coming up soon. And I streamed art and design recently as well. So if you want to see any of that, you know, tune in and check it out. That's twitch.tv/radicalhawks. That does it for, oh, and if you like, you can follow me on Twitter at Jeff Craig Design to get updates on when I'm streaming and also see other cool things. That does it for Jeff plugs, and that does it for our episode. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See ya.